Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, April 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Science Forum, boys and girls, and we have a science team ready to answer your most difficult science questions, or at least try to answer your most difficult science questions. The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, whether it be easy, moderate, or hard, 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Got a few of those already. voxpop@wamc.org or 800-348-2551. Science Forum, your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's time to reconvene the Science Forum. And boy, there's a lot going on we want to talk about today. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org for the emails. And we got a few of those already. The number is 800-348-2551. Yes, the Science Forum. We had a major launch from NASA yesterday down at Cape Kennedy. But before we do that, let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Hi, it's Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill, currently on sabbatical and enjoying my time doing research on water
quality.
It's
almost over, you know.
I know.
All right.
Hi, I'm Kevin Knuth. I'm a physics professor at the University at Albany.
Excuse me. I'm Jim Pickett, and I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired now.
Ed Stander, geology, astronomy, environmental science, and anything that Barbara can't answer.
You know, you wanted to talk about sulfide.
Nickel sulfides, yeah.
Why?
Because they're cool.
That's it.
Yeah.
Nickel sulfides are cool.
Well, last time we were here, we had a long talk about shower doors that blew up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
Right, shower doors that blew up. And so I did a whole bunch of research as to why the shower doors blew up.
Right.
And it turns out that when you make glass that shatters, what you do is you effectively make the piece of glass and then you quench it very, very quickly, which means you cool it very fast.
Yeah.
So all the stresses stay in the glass. Because otherwise, in a normal piece of glass, you would just float it on tin, for example, a liquid tin, and it would cool off very slowly.
Yeah.
But because they quench it, inside the glass, if there's any impurities, the impurities get locked in there. And in the case of shower curtains or shower glass, there's an impurity called nickel sulfide. And it's something that just happens to be all over the place in China. Don't ask me why.
Hmm.
But nickel sulfide, if you cool it very quickly, it gets locked in what's called the alpha phase. And the alpha phase is nickel sulfide in a particular crystalline form. If you then wait for 2 or 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, it slowly changes to its beta form. And when it does, it increases in volume by about 5%.
Ah,
and that's what would break it.
Increases in 5%, what it does is it puts a lot of stress on one location, and once one of the things goes, all of them go, and the whole thing shatters.
Well, let me ask you a practical question, panel. If this can be avoided by slowly cooling the glass, why don't they slowly cool the glass?
Because then when you fall into it, it forms shards.
Yeah, they want it. They quench it early so that you have those rounded corner pieces so that you don't bleed to death when you're cut by the shower door when it breaks. They could just remove the nickel from as an impurity, but they have to remove all of it, and that's expensive.
Yeah, and somehow a pattern is imprinted.
Well, the pattern effectively is automatic. The pattern occurs because once one piece of the glass breaks, it reduces the stress in that direction, and the other direction starts taking up all the stress.
But the stress pattern's already in the glass.
No, it's
no. You can see it with polarized sunglasses.
So you can bring sunglasses in, and you can tell.
Well, no.
You use sunglasses if you in your shower?
This is an interesting shower conversation.
Sometimes when, for example,
what are you wearing when you look
black? I know.
No. The back window of a car is tempered glass.
Right.
And you can see that groove
pattern. And you can see, if you're wearing polarized sunglasses and the sun's in the right position, reflections are such that you can see where the stresses are in the glass. And it's this checkerboard pattern.
Amazing.
Well, yeah, the checkerboard pattern, though, is made because during quenching, it actually, there are points where there's less stress. And as you go away from those points, the stress increases. So you wind up effectively having a whole thousands of these little points in one location. And then in between, you develop what are called Thiessen polygons.
Interesting. Interesting. Mm. Well, we've probably killed most of the audience by now, so let's go to the email bag.
Well, thanks.
No, it's interesting, right?
It took me a long time to figure that stuff out.
We know now why it happens, so we just don't want to get glass,
well,
right?
Well, what's important is that you look at the bottom of the glass when you're going to buy it and find out where it was made.
So don't get Chinese.
Don't get cheap Chinese glass in your shower. That's right.
So are there better standards in America?
There are different ways of tempering it as well.
Really?
Which actually it says on the bottom of the glass.
I'll be darned. And what are we looking for in the bottom of the glass then? Which tempering is the way?
Oh, you'd have to wait for that. I'd have to find that.
Why don't you do some more research and we'll start the show with that again
next
month as well. All right, so this email came out. I want to talk about the launch, but Kevin's having some trouble with the parking, so we're gonna do some emails first, and then we'll, you know, technology makes everything easy. So there's this parking app, and he's been working on it. This is like, you know, you people are some of the smartest people I know.
And he's a half an hour into the parking app.
And if he can't do it, I mean, he's a physysicist.
For the $1.30
well, that's why.
City of Albany's going to get.
Properly.
How are we doing over there?
I'm making my way on the web, actually. The app didn't work. It's poorly programmed.
Yeah, there you go. Well, let's just go to the email bag, and then we'll get back to that later. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, Kevin Knuth, and Barb Brabets. This email from Jonathan came in yesterday. If it's true that artificial fertilizer will be expensive because of the Iran war, and if it's true that soybeans already create their own natural fertilizer, are there any good ways to genetically engineer soybeans to become a more popular crop to replace fertilizer-starved wheat? Or would it be cheaper to engineer wheat so that it makes its own fertilizer like soy does?
Well, part of that's already done. Soybeans have been genetically modified over the years for nitrogen supplementation, which is actually not the soybean itself, but it's a symbiotic relationship that it has with microbes in the soil. So it hosts its legumes, right? It's a legume. So its root tendrils give a location for soil microbiome that does the nitrogen fixation from the air to the soil. But the problem is, of course, that takes a whole season to do, right? You've got to grow the soybean and then let it supplement the soil during that season and then harvest them and then plant something else. So that's why soil rotation was found all those years ago to really work well. They didn't really know what was going on, but they figured it out. If you had the sequence of things in your crops in your field, that you would keep the field going longer and it wouldn't exhaust itself. There was two parts of the GM. It was, why don't we add this to wheat? Or it was another one.
Hang on, let me get it out of the file. Are there good ways to genetically engineer soybeans to make it more popular crop to replace fertilizer-starved wheat, or would it be cheaper to engineer wheat to make its own fertilizer?
Right. So the wheat with its own fertilizer, there's, it's not a legume, so it doesn't really have the goods underneath the soil to be able to host those soil microorganisms that can harvest nitrogen. But what we have found is that if we don't till the soil, that is, if we leave the soil intact and just make a hole in the soil, like think of your finger like putting a plug down in the soil and then drop the wheat directly into that, that no-till actually helps keep the existing microbiome underneath the soil intact. And it's better for nitrogen, not fixation, but rather keeping the nitrogen in the soil, keeping the soil from degrading. And so this so-called seed injection method is a lot of what farmers use these days. But they have to borrow the equipment sometimes. Co-ops will have this equipment on loan rather than have to throw out all your old till type of material and then start from scratch.
And there's also more to fertilizer than just the nitrogen.
Correct. It's, you know, the three components are N, P, and K. So that's nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And really the two big, potassium is usually not a problem. It's usually the nitrogen and the phosphorus that are the biggies.
There's a lot of nitrogen. Shouldn't that be easy?
It's not the right form. Or if it's in the form of nitrate, which is the big one, that's the one that's very bioavailable. That's the one that plants love to have. It's kind of like the Dorito that sits out on the countertop. You know, like, it'll get eaten eventually.
Is that the explosive stuff?
It can be, yeah. It depends in what form it is, in its salt form. Because sometimes we do ammonium nitrate, so we have ammonium has a nitrogen component as well, and nitrate has another nitrogen component. So when you have these artificial fertilizers like ammonium nitrate, that's explosive, but you get almost a 2-to-1 ratio as to the amount of fertilizing it can do. When you apply it, because both parts of the molecule actually do fertilization.
Interesting. All right, one more email here for now, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll do some other stuff. The subject heading on this is Wisecracker. Can you guess who it's directed to? Yes, Ed. Why is nickel sulfide all over the place in China? That's from Kay in Cornwallville. Wisecracker, what do you think?
Well, because everything is all over the place in China, because they don't clean the...
So this is a product of pollution?
It's a product of pollution.
Aha. All right. On that happy note, we'll take a break. 800-348-2551. The parking app is being dissected. We'll have Kevin Knuth on mic in a couple few hours. We'll be fine. Hey, guess what? We're going to the Landis Arboretum on April 22nd for a live recording of the gardening show. That's Earth Day. And if you want to be a part of that, you can go to wamc.org/on the road. I am told by Peter Hughes, who's the head honcho of the whole on the road thing, that the tickets are going fast. So if you want to go, go to wamc.org/on the road. And there you are. Okay, it's Vox Pop on WAMC. And we have Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabitz here, and soon to be Kevin Knuth. Let's do a couple more emails, and then we'll... I'm trying to hold off on the space launch questions until the physicist is back. Matt says this. Oh, this is slower than the speed of light. All right, Ed Wisecracker, this is on you. Matt writes, if you turn on a lamp, but the light is traveling at less than the speed of light, as in a supernova, how would that lamp light appear to us after we switch it on? I don't know what I just read.
What? You're going to have to read it again.
If you turn on a lamp, but the light is traveling at less than the speed of light, as in a supernova, how would that lamp light appear to us after we switch it on? My head's about to...
I don't think light travels any different speed in a... Well, in a supernova, no.
I would only argue...
In a black hole?
I would only argue that if it's traveling... Light traveling at the speed of light... It's going to look like light.
Yeah.
Even when we slow down light by putting it, we can make light go not the speed of light. I mean, it's this roundabout argument, but we all accept that there's a constant for the speed of light. But the asterisk at the end of that sentence is that's in a vacuum. So it's 3.0 × 10⁸ meters per second in a vacuum. We can slow down light by putting it through dense substances that still have transmission, and we can make light go thousands of miles an hour, so much, much slower. Well, it's still light.
But
it's just that the speed of light in that substance is less than the standard that we accept to be the speed of light.
What is slowing it down? It's not friction. Is there any...
Electromagnetic inference, yeah. Things that are happening within the material.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
All right, how about one that it just feels like home? Freezing water. Jeff from Troy asks, assume constant atmospheric conditions in which the temperature is 33 degrees Fahrenheit and the wind is blowing such that the wind chill is 20 degrees. Then you place a container of pure water in direct path of the wind. Does the water freeze or not? I say no, says Jeff in Troy.
And I think you're right. The only way you could get it colder is if something's evaporating off the surface.
Which it would in the breeze. You'd get some evaporation. Yes. That's why we get lake effect snow, right? You get evaporation off the Great Lakes, and right. Then that feeds moisture into the atmosphere.
But if the container is dry, it's not going to get any colder than the
air. I was thinking it was like an open cup. Is the top open? Here I go. Sorry, yeah. Ray.
This one's electronic, so the file's
back to the file.
After Kevin's done with the parking app, I'll have him try to retrieve this one.
And it also is a question, by the way, of the surface area of the particle. If you have a lot of, for example, if you take water and you throw it in the air at 33 degrees, and there's a lot of wind, then you'll get much more evaporation, and it could freeze.
All right, here's one. Do ocean waves, when measured in the scale of human perception, like 10 yards to a mile, I guess, have a pattern, or are they random? And that's from Nick.
They have a pattern.
You know
that if you go to the shore and watch them come in.
And if you fly over the ocean, it's amazing. You can't really tell. Barring anything else, like an island or something else, you mm-hmm. can't tell it whether you're 6 feet above the water or 10,000 feet above the water.
Yep.
That's true. There are rogue waves, though, and they try to talk about where do these rogue waves come from. Yep. And it seems to be some of the interference of tide, which, of course, will influence the back and forth of the water. And then also some currents, and then things like islands or shoals that are just underneath the surface, because then what you have is you're disrupting this regular pattern. You're not disrupting it, but you're creating a more complex pattern within the simple pattern.
Yeah.
And that's when you can get these rogue waves.
Yeah. And in a typical wave pattern, you'll usually have every 10th wave, for example, will be larger than the other waves. But that's all due to the fetch of the wind going over the top of the top of the water.
The science forum is in progress. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Listen, Merle and Argyle has been waiting a long time, and we need to hear from Merle. So pot them down just slightly, Mike, so we don't blow our headphones off. And let's go to Merle and Argyle. Hello, Merle.
I'm here, and I can hear you.
All right, man.
But not very well.
Oh, great.
But I can hear you.
Okay.
All right. The question has to do with coffee and cooling effect of a cup of coffee out of a coffee pot, opposed to nuking, microwaving a cup of coffee. Mm. And it seems to me that when you put it in the microwave, it cools faster. Maybe I've asked this question before.
Yeah, Merle, you have, and you sent me on homework. I had 2 months' worth of homework.
Really?
With
did
coffee.
You answer the homework?
I did.
What was your grade
all
on the
right.
homework?
Yeah, so the question wasn't quite the way you've put it to me today, but I'll tell you what the homework was that I did.
Okay.
We had coffee that was brewed, and then coffee that was brewed in a conventional drip coffee maker. Into an identical type of cup. And then in the same other cup, we heated it up to the same temperature in a microwave. And then we pulled the two out, and then we kept thermometers in them and then watched the temperature decrease with time. And they decreased essentially the same. So they lost temperature the same.
Oh.
So the question is, maybe your coffee maker, because I've thought about this, Merle, in the months since, like what would have caused the question to happen in your mind? Maybe your coffee maker is overheating your coffee. Maybe that's you're used to, like there's a certain temperature range, about 125, 130 Fahrenheit, that your coffee usually comes out. Maybe your coffee maker has either an overzealous burner or a heater element that doesn't have a good thermostatic control on it, so that you're getting 140 or 145 degree coffee out of your coffee maker. And in your microwave, you're only going to get so high before you pull it out. I mean, I don't like setting my coffee to boil in the microwave because, first off, it makes a mess.
Yeah.
Right. And I can't really drink 212 degree coffee.
That's a good point.
So maybe your coffee maker just is a little hot in comparison to everybody else's.
Do you remember any of this initial conversation, Merle? Because if not, your memory is just as bad as mine, man. I got to say, I don't remember it at all.
Well, I remember asking the question, and thank you for doing the homework, and thank you for the answer.
Oh, you're welcome. And
I just
did strictly coffee, no milk, no sugar, just coffee.
Nice. And she drinks so much coffee. It's
really
worthwhile doing.
How much coffee do you drink?
I've had 4 cups today.
Well, that's not that much.
Well, I know, Ray, in your world.
No,
but...
no, I'm off the
Well,
stuff,
I mean, oh, well, I mine's it. Decaf as well, so it's really just brown water.
Well, you know, really? You drink decaf?
It's a heart thing.
Yep. Ah, yeah. I see. Well, you know, I tell you what, we got to go to Joan, who's got a space launch question. But Joan, the physicist isn't here, but we'll give it a shot, right? 800-348-2551. Hello, Joan.
Hello, hello, all of you. I have to admit, I cried. I watched the launch, and I cried like I was, oh, dear.
It was cool. No, it was great. We watched it at my house, too, for a couple hours. I mean,
yeah,
it was awesome.
I waited 50 years. I realized I waited 50 years.
Me too.
To see that.
Yeah, I think,
event again.
Joan, some of us that are of a certain age, it was part of the spectacle of our childhood, right? And I wonder if for the Gen Zers, they don't even really, they don't really understand why it's important to us.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a tough sell. I was watching it on my phone in a restaurant, and I asked them if they could put, it was in a sports bar, and I asked them if they could put it up on one of the, you know, like take off the, you know, I don't know, donkey volleyball and put up Artemis 2. And they were like, what?
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a very small select it's number of people, but still.
It's hard getting old. I'm still waiting for the Beatles to come back.
Oh, boy. Well.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Anyway.
I had a true question.
Okay.
About, unbelievably, what also survived 50 years is certain belief that it didn't really happen, that people didn't ever
We're really going to go there, aren't we? Well, hang on. Let's let Kevin Knuth just got back in the studio. Let's have him put his headphone on. Ask the question again, and then we'll all take a whack at this. Go ahead.
Oh, this is going to be fun. I would like a full arsenal of responses to some of the naysayers who I've heard already say that wasn't real. We didn't see
the moon landing was faked, you know, is what Jonas
said.
Moon,
how do we the prove original that it wasn't was faked, and that even what we saw yesterday, some of it was faked. Obviously, there was a whole bunch of people watching with their own eyes, so something went into the air.
I mean, gosh, all the people were right there when it happened. But anyway, let's go to Kevin first, since he's now back with us.
Thanks, guys.
All right, go ahead.
All right, wow. Well, they landed 6 times in the Apollo mission, so it's amazing to fake it 6 times. Why would you bother? But even so, as a physics professor at the university, I have a when we had COVID, I was teaching an experimental physics lab course. And we couldn't do experiments in the lab. Everybody was at home, so I had to make up at-home experiments for them to do and learn physics. And so one of the experiments I had is I had them watch a video of, I think it was David Scott, dropping a feather and a hammer on the moon. And and so their experiment, the job was to estimate the acceleration of gravity from that video. And my students did that. And of course, you get 1/6 the acceleration of Earth's gravity. And so you can verify that they're actually on the moon.
Or they were 6 times higher up above the Earth.
All right, so that's a good way to do it, Barbara.
With there's stuff left behind on the moon, and that is visible with a telescope. I got to know from the other side of the room. We've had this question.
Japanese orbiters have imaged them.
Yes,
they're from orbiters, but not from telescopes.
Yeah. Okay, not from telescopes. So an orbiter taking a photo, is that what we're doing?
Yeah.
A camera?
Yes. We've seen the flag.
Yeah. Yep. Right.
All right.
So
fair
the
enough.
Stuff. Like the RPI buggy.
Okay. Is that good for you, Joan?
Yeah. And thanks, guys, for everything you all do to make it possible.
Thank you for calling. 800-348-2551. Okay. So a great launch yesterday. Loved it. There was a great question. Before we get to the translunar injection, insertion, whatever you call it, yesterday there was a press conference about an hour after the launch. Kevin, were you still watching then?
No,
you were
still
watching. Okay.
Yeah.
So a French journalist said, you know, they did this basically with slide rules 50 years ago. How is it we never went back? And it was it's a great question that's always bothered me. And the NASA higher up said, well, it's basically we had done it. There was no reason to do it again, and it cost a lot, and there were other priorities. Yeah?
That's what I would have said, for sure.
Exactly.
So what happens today, about 6:35, I guess, about 24 hours after the launch, is the TLI. Kevin, can you tell us what's happening and why it's so important that they get it right?
Right. Well, the TLI stands for translunar injection.
Injection, or insertion.
And what they're basically doing right now, they're in orbit around the Earth, and they're going to turn on their rockets and accelerate and basically move into another orbit, which takes them higher up and off to the moon. So when they first launched, they launched into a low Earth orbit, a nice circular low Earth orbit, about probably around the same altitude the space shuttle goes at. They're going about 18,000 miles an hour. And then after one orbit around the Earth, they accelerated slightly. They changed what they called, they changed the apogee height, which is the farthest distance from the Earth. So they went into an elliptic orbit. They accelerated a little bit and kept it so the ellipse is basically tangent to the circular orbit and at the low Earth orbit height, but then goes about an eighth of the way to the moon, actually, and comes back around. And that's why it took them about a day to make that transit in that elliptic orbit. So it allowed them to test their systems far away from Earth and then brought them right back close to Earth again. In case there was a problem, they could just land.
And so from what I understand, and I forget how much actual thrust there was yesterday when it took off off the Earth, but it's much less. It's 20,000 whatever pounds of thrust. But it's a controlled burn. And as I understand it, it's 5 or 6 minutes, and they have to get this thing right or they're not going to go where they got to go.
Right, yeah. But you have to have the right amount of thrust to get on the right orbit.
What I found most interesting, and they did this in the Apollo days too, was this idea that once that burn is done, the TLI is done, there's no more thrust. They're going all on gravity. They're going around the moon, and then they're coming home the same way.
Yep.
Explain how that works, and then we'll get back to the phones.
Yeah, this orbit is designed so that it basically makes a figure eight around the moon. So they'll head off from the Earth, and then it'll orbit the moon and come back around toward Earth, and then they'll
But how does it work?
Land.
How does it work? In other words, without propulsion, how can you do that?
As you get closer to an object in space, with the high gravity, you can use the gravity to assist. So as it gets closer, it'll actually speed up as it goes around it. So you get effectively slingshotted off the moon back to the Earth.
I'm trying to think of how to visualize this, like on the radio.
Yeah. Well, and once the burn stops, then the spacecraft keeps moving, but it keeps getting slowing down.
So what's slowing it down?
Earth's gravity.
Gravity.
Ah, okay.
So Earth's gravity is slowing it down, but it's going fast enough that it kind of makes it over the hump where moon's gravity captures it. Moon's gravity swings it around the moon. Now it's moving fast again past the moon so that it can escape the moon's gravity, makes it over the hump again, and then falls back to Earth.
Incredible. And that they can plot this out, and they did that all those years ago as well.
With human computers. That's what they were called. The job was called a computer, but it wasn't an instrument. It was a person and calculations.
Incredible. The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Florida already. Kit, you're on. Go ahead.
Hey, how you guys? Yes, I heard, I think it was Joan's comment. And, about her crying. And I witnessed the launch from, right across from the causeway with, I don't know, 500,000 other people. And, when you need to be a proud American, that's the time, Just, a comment out there. And I believe they were the fastest humans ever. And they're going to be the farthest human from Earth ever. So,
yeah, that's true, I guess. But how much farther are they going? I mean, not that much further, because Apollo 13 did the same trick, right?
The Apollo 13 did the same trick. I don't know the details, but this capsule isn't designed to orbit the moon very closely. So they're not So in Apollo, they basically, in Apollo 8, they went over the moon about 60 miles above the surface.
Yeah.
They're going to be much further away from the moon as they go around it this time.
Right.
But that also puts them, puts them further from the Earth than Apollo had gone.
All right, Kit.
Not only Apollo, anyone ever.
Yeah.
Anyone
yeah,
ever,
cool.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Well, I tell you, I remember all those launches too, and I was thrilled too. Kit, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. We'll check the email bag again when we return. Fox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets, Kevin Knuth, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander here with us today. And let's check the email bag. But first, some late breaking news from Barbara Brabets.
Yes, I have people who have contacted me to clarify our statement about the evaporation of water.
Well, who's that?
This is my father.
Okay, what are his qualifications?
He has a PhD in polymer chemistry.
All right.
And he's my father.
That'll be
no
fine.
No relationship with water.
None.
Okay.
Anyway, he wanted me to clarify, or maybe he's clarifying to me in case he thought I didn't know, that evaporation can cool droplets of water from 33 Fahrenheit to below freezing, but the freezing point of water still remains 32 Fahrenheit.
Oh, thank heavens.
Yeah. So yeah. now that's cleared up.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Chris writes in, our first lunar program fueled our economy. It's still fueling it. To the best of your knowledge, panel, is there anything in this new lunar program that could boost our economy? Helium-3. Plenty of helium-3.
Helium-3. Water on the moon. All of those things. I mean, it's funny because we're not even doing the Apollo missions. They would go around the moon like 1.5 times. We're not even doing a full rotation around the moon. We're just going around the backside and then flinging back towards Earth. So whatever we're doing on that backside, we're doing it quickly. We don't, obviously we have better optics than we had, although the optics were great in the 60s, but, we're not spending a lot of time around that moon the way we were on the Apollo missions. So we're looking for stuff, I think.
Anybody else? No?
I think those are nods. It's hard to tell on the radio.
You know, the plan is in a year or two to land people near the South Pole where there is frozen water.
Yeah, 2027 or 2028.
Right. And so I guess the idea is a base, which will be a launching point for future explorations, right?
Well, right, because water could be split with solar power. Water can be split into hydrogen and oxygen, and then you now have fuel. So that can be used as fuel sources for we need.
Right. And if we keep on having satellites up in space, it's going to come to a point where we're not going to be able to get off the Earth anymore, so we're going to need a moon base.
Yeah, there's too much traffic in space these days.
You know, I was thinking about that, and they showed in the pregame of this launch this couple pages, and it showed all the windows where they could actually, if they delayed the launch, they could, okay, you got to wait 5 minutes, and then you have this launch, because there is so much crap up there already. You know, remember that Bond movie, You Only Live Twice,
mm-hmm.
where that satellite at the beginning was like an alligator? I think it was based on something real, a satellite. Why couldn't they get a few of those and just vacuum up all the crud?
They're talking about it. They're talking about setting up satellites with nets to catch the satellites, to catch errant satellites, if you will. And one of the biggest problems they're having right now is that not only are we sending up satellites, but other countries are as well, and they all have to talk to each other to know where the satellites are. Because if something were to happen, for example, a solar flare were to hit a couple of satellites, it could cause a chain reaction and knock the whole bloody mess out.
Ooh, okay. Peter in Barryville writes, when I'm out walking the pooch at night, I hope that's not a euphemism of some kind. When I'm out walking the pooch at night, I sometimes shine the flashlight that I'm carrying into the dark sky. What happens to that light? Does it just keep going as the light from the sun does? And that's from Peter in Barryville.
It keeps on going, but it expands. The size of the beam become larger and larger until the amount of light you're seeing just effectively disappears.
Yeah, so by scattering off of ash or whatever else, other stuff that's up in the sky.
All right, let's see. This is from Mike in Rexford. Why do they use the term fixing nitrogen? Was it broken? Where did the term come from?
That's a great question. It is an ancient term. It really is. It's the idea of making an bio-unavailable nitrogen, dinitrogen gas, for example, which is the stuff that makes up 70-odd% of our atmosphere. And really, it's just there taking up space. And, yeah, we can get the bends and stuff if we, you know, change altitude too quickly. But generally speaking, we don't have any way, and many organisms on this planet don't have any way of using it. And then we have a subclass of these microbes whose superpower is that they can take this bio-unavailable nitrogen form as dinitrogen, the gas, and then they can convert it to a molecular form like nitrate or even ammonia. And that then takes it from I can't use it biologically to now I can use it biologically.
Ah.
Ammonia is not great for us, but other organisms can do with ammonia. Most of the higher plants and animals need nitrate, which is an NO3 with a -1 charge.
And it may be used the term fixed because you're taking something which is gaseous and putting it in one spot.
Okay.
You're fixing it there.
Dawn writes in, two unrelated, I think, questions. Why does celery keep fresh so well wrapped in aluminum foil? That's one.
Doesn't lose water.
Okay, we'll take that. And then the second question, the amazing transporting CERN antimatter factory of antimatter. Your thoughts.
Okay, I saw this. This is a truck.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Well, yeah, and then they got... So the truck looks cool, but inside the truck is this box.
Right.
Actually, Kevin should probably be talking about this, about the magnets in order to hold
the antimatter
particles.
Right.
So it doesn't bump into anything.
Right. The ultimate UPS job.
Right. So there we go.
Or you can pull it closer to you. It's the other way if you want to do that. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so to keep the antimatter from touching anything, you have to basically keep it in a torus, a donut shaped, and the antimatter circulates in this donut shaped, and you can use magnets to keep it focused, moving around.
All right, stop. Let me stop you there. For those who don't know, why do you have to keep the antimatter separate?
Because when antimatter comes in contact with matter, they annihilate each other and turn into light, basically gamma rays.
And so what our writer was alluding to was this huge truck, and how much antimatter do they actually carry? Whether they go a couple miles with it or not even?
Yeah, I think they just they go to the other side of the CERN campus.
Yeah,
but and it's only I think what you can count on your fingers and toes number of antiprotons in there.
So yeah. Why is that significant? Kevin, that they've been able to transport this?
Well, it's very hard to do. That's one of the reasons. One of the amazing things about it, you have to keep the antimatter from touching any matter at all. So you've got to keep it in a vacuum, and you've got to keep it circulating in this donut-shaped region.
I mean, most of us think of antimatter, and at least I do. I think of Star Trek, and I never thought it was real until recently, but this was pivotal in the creation of the universe, right?
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Considering that it's making gamma rays, what did they make the box out of it just in case something happened?
Well, somebody
drew a short straw to drive that truck, let me tell you.
Well, no, there's so few particles that
yeah,
it's an insignificant amount of radiation.
All right, here's another one, and then we'll jump back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. With Barbara Brabitz, Kevin Knuth, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, Pamela in Troy writes, I live in Troy, okay, so stipulated, where I can hear the bugle calls from the Watervliet Arsenal if there's not too much ambient noise. However, I notice that sometimes the call is quite clear and distinct, other times seems kind of faint and barely audible, listening from the same vantage point. I believe it's a recording, not an actual bugler these days, so not a question of someone too pooped to puff. Is how the sound, that's very nice, is how the sound carries influenced by atmospheric conditions, humidity, what conditions produce the clear sound, and which the less audible sound? And that's from Pamela in Troy.
Well, I can tell you that the more humid the air is, the less likely it's going to be able to be heard. Because the humidity actually deadens the sound, and you'll hear that in any forest you go into. if you're trying to listen to the wind going through the trees. If it's a humid place, you don't hear it.
Yeah, and similarly, colder transmits sound better than warmer. So your colder, drier day is going to, and of course, there's always traffic noise to compete with the Arsenal too, because you've got 787 there.
Right.
But so colder and drier mornings would probably be the best time, and it's bugle time, so you know.
And the wind could literally carry it away.
Sure.
And even better would be a cold ground and then warm air above it.
Right. So like a bank of clouds just above it to kind of capture the noise.
That's right.
Yep. Just like with radio waves.
Interesting. The number here is 800-348-2551. Richard is in Rensselaer. Richard.
Yes. I'd like to know about the electrons in the P layer of neon. It seems to me that these noble gases, that the electrons can always be thought of as forming vertices of a geometric solid, but it seems to me they'd be best if they formed the vertices of a regular geometric solid. So what is the shape of the solid of the P electrons in neon?
They point to the corners of a tetrahedron, but those are mathematical descriptions.
Of probability.
Of probability. You really have more or less spherical symmetry around the whole atom.
Yeah, the 97% probability density map of electrons in a P orbital are dumbbell shaped. But you take three different dumbbells and you kind of conjoin them together and you get kind of what would look like a puffy flower with six different petals kind of sticking out in three dimensions. That, again, is just 90% probability that the electrons are within that shape. 10% is a lot, if you think about it, because you could be an electron in neon and be at the Amtrak station. You don't have to even be within the constraints of that 90% probability. There's just a few places that the electrons can't be, and the math tells us they can't be in the nucleus, because if they're in the nucleus, then they're no longer electrons.
Thank you, Richard. I'm so confused by this. And Kevin, you're hip to the quantum a little bit. I was reading on this today. These electrons, when we talk about electrons, it's not like a planet circling.
No.
It's not a wave function?
It is a wave function. It's traveling at 80% the speed of light, an electron.
It's just energy?
It's
a ripple?
It's mass, but it's very, very light mass. So a proton weighs what we call one atomic mass unit. So let's just call it one heavy piece, okay? A neutron, one heavy piece. An electron is 1/1800th of that same mass.
Mm.
So it's 2,000 times less massive than a proton, which means that it behaves differently because it's got that quantum effect. It has the waveform, wave function, approaching the speed of light characteristics.
Kevin, do you have anything that I can understand?
You can think of the electrons. I mean, we talk about them orbiting the nucleus, but you can think of them as basically forming a cloud around the nucleus.
Like a field?
As they're moving around, right. And the wave function, which allows you to calculate the probability, gives you a probability map of where you can expect to find an electron. So these are the interesting shapes, like the dumbbell shape that you get for a P orbital. It kind of has two opposite facing lobes. Those are basically where it is most probable to find that electron in that type of orbit.
So as we conventionally conceive mass, it really doesn't exist then, does it?
It exists, but it's not
definable.
Like a planet. It's not like definable. They're not like billiard balls. Our first thought was that these are like little planets orbiting a sun, but that's not.
No, the fact
really
that we even still call them orbitals really irks me. And Ed knows this is one of my pet peeves. Like the whole idea of the Bohr model of the atom, where you see kind of like carousel, the nucleus is the center of the carousel, and then, you know, riding the horses around in a circle are electrons. It's all baloney. We've known that it's been baloney since the 1930s, but this is what we teach in high school because it's a convenient way to make an accounting for all of the electrons. But the properties of the electrons are so different that it's kind of silly to even teach that anyway. It'd be better to just teach the properties of the electrons.
I mean, the kids aren't listening anyway, are they?
I have to unteach the Bohr model, and I do so usually with profanity.
It's a 90% probability that they're not listening.
All right, let's jump back to the phones. It's the Science Forum. James is in Beacon. James, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question about the moon. And, like, I was discussing with a coworker the other day, like, how come we never see the backside of the moon? Like, I just didn't have a good way to kind of...
Oh, Ed, you've been on this before.
Yeah, it's because of tidal locking. What happens is the moon probably used to spin, but as it spun, what would happen is the side facing the Earth would actually get pulled towards the Earth, and it would form a wave called an Earth wave, effectively. And it takes a lot of energy to move something like that around. So what it does is as the moon is... as rotating, it's actually slowing down. It slows the Earth. It slows the Moon down until the point where it's always facing the same direction towards the Earth. Every moon in the entire solar system does the same thing, and for the same reason.
All right, James.
Okay, thank you.
I think it's pretty cool. I mean, Wiseman, I think, said about 60% of the far side of the Moon has not been seen before. And so this is pretty exciting. I mean, they're going to be able to take some real photographs or make some observations. I think it's pretty neat.
Oh, there's even something better about it, too, is that the craters of the moon are all named after scientists. And since there's a whole bunch back there that haven't been seen,
right,
there's a good chance I'll get named for one.
Ed, Jim, Kevin, and Barb will all get one.
It's all been mapped by the lunar orbiter.
Oh, stop it. Stop it.
But people seeing it.
Yeah. I mean,
people haven't seen it
with their own eyes.
So it's very exciting. And I can't wait for this. And the TLI is about, what, I think 6:35 today. So hopefully everything goes well. There's a chance that they might delay it or scrub it and then come back to Earth.
Is there going to be a period of time where we lose contact with them because they're on the dark side?
30 to 50 minutes, they think.
Yeah,
when they're on the dark side. I was reading something online about it again because we're all kind of fascinated. And I noticed that they have bunkers for them should there be a solar flare, which I thought was real. They have like a duck and cover for inside the orbiter, which I thought was crazy because up to this point in the Apollo, they didn't really have anything.
What did they do 50 years ago?
Yeah, right.
You're on
well,
your own,
you know,
fellas.
Most of those guys live to be ripe old ages.
It's important now because the sun is very active.
Yes,
so that's
we're in a solar
problem.
Max. So.
And in fact, we shouldn't really call it the dark side.
There's plenty of light.
It's the far side.
Yeah.
And the far side of the moon is sometimes lit up.
Right.
So it's not always dark.
So you think they're going to name one of those craters after Gary Larson then?
Oh, that would be great.
I think so.
Better than Pink Floyd.
Yeah, we're going to have to change the Pink Floyd album.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's quickly go. We only have about 45 seconds. Joyce in Brattleboro. Joyce, go ahead.
My question is, they talk about that there's water on the moon. And assuming that that's just plain H2O and that it's potable, is that really accurate or is that an illusion that it's going to be contaminated by some unknown substance so it's not potable?
Okay, so we have about 30 seconds, panel. Go ahead.
It's not potability that's really the issue. They want to be, because we can always clean up the water, right? We can always distill it and whatever is in it. You know, the material that's in it would then be left behind. So we can always clean it up. We have solar energy to be able to do that, right? It's really ice that they're looking for. The ice could be associated in rocks, or it could be ice that's formed on rock. And they want to be able to take that and then split it electrolytically into hydrogen and oxygen to use for fuel.
Joyce.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot. All right, now. Barbara, you're back in school for the next semester, right? You're
In the fall, yes.
All right, and we'll get an update on that in the next one. Kevin Knuth, what's happening over at the school? Anything good?
Oh, we're working away. The semester's
month to go.
1 month to go?
Yeah, you look tired. Barbara looks relaxed. Jim, what's going on?
Summer's coming.
Fighting with a reviewer on paper I submitted.
Oh, really? Does it get ugly?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is great. Let him have it. Bennett Cerf style. Ed, what's happening with you?
I'm just looking for more jokes to tell on the air.
You know what? What were you, a wisecracker? What did they call you?
That's all I do.
All right, man, good job. Support, you have a PhD in that. Support comes from Cowpots and Freunds Farm Market, Connecticut farm family, striving to create a sustainable alternative and future by turning composted cow manure into renewable and biodegradable pots for gardens. Cowpots.com. And Oakwood Friends School, boarding on day 6th to 12th, announcing their open houses, virtual on April 12th and 23rd, and in person on Thursday, April 26th. Oakwoodfriends.org to register. Okay, an eventful show. Thanks to Barb, Ed, Kevin, Jim for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer, the great Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, grain zealot, pro flower agitator Amy Halloran will be here. We'll see you too.